Cats in Hell, a look back at Saturday Night Live with your hosts, Matt and Keith. Brought to you by Lion's Den Audio Theater. Like and subscribe to Lion's Den Audio Theater for more Lion's Den goodness. And here are your hosts, Keith and Matt.
Saturday Night Live, Season 4, Episode 5, starring Buck Henry. Originally aired on November 11th, 1978. Hello, everyone. Welcome to SN Hell. My name is Keith. With me, as always, my ride or die till the end and good buddy. His name is Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Keith. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. With us tonight, as close to our resident Buck Henry expert as we've got. I think you've been with us for 5 of the 7 now. It's Mark. Hello, Mark.
Hey, fellas.
You know, somebody was asking me the other day, one of our listeners was asking, like, how I feel about the other podcasters that are out there. Some have been doing it longer than us. Some have been doing it shorter than us. Some are following the same stuff we're doing. Some are following completely different stuff. Great podcasting community out there. Well, we're certainly out on the fringes, the outer fringes, I suppose, if even that close. I love the fact that this great show has so many people talking, especially folks that aren't, you know, mainstream media. So I'm big thumbs up for everything, right?
Yes, this is even though ours is the only one that acts as a public service.
Yeah, we have some unique views. I think they like us on the fringes. Tonight is Buck Henry's 7th time at the helm. You know, back at this point in time, Buck Henry is the primo host.
Sure makes sense to me. Pops up every so often. He feels like part of the cast. He's not the big star Steve Martin is, so I wasn't really aware of him, like, as being, you know, because we always say, like, oh, I used to think Steve Martin was part of the cast because he's featured in so many, like, highlight reels and, you know, best of compilations, whereas Buck is simply not.
I didn't even, like, know about Buck Henry before getting involved in this project, so it's kind of neat to see just how involved he was and how he does seem like just part of the cast when he's in there. There seems to be a lot of camaraderie, and there's almost more of a relaxed vibe, it seems, now whenever he's on. Like, they're happy to have him around, you know?
Yeah, I was doing some reading this past week or so, and there was a falling out at one point between Lauren and Buck, and I do wonder if that might have affected his appearances on these best of compilations that happened.
Any gossip there on what happened?
No, I don't know what it is. Our musical guest tonight is the Grateful Dead. From what I've read, writer Tom Davis, major Deadhead, was a big pusher of getting the Dead on the show. Not the only reason, but a big part of the reason as to why the Dead were there. Any thoughts on the Grateful Dead, fellas?
My first experience with the Grateful Dead was actually fairly young. They had a hit, I believe, very late in their career in the 90s, Touch of Grey.
Yeah, it was the 80s. Yeah. Yep.
Was that the 80s? Okay. I forget how much of a kid I was in the 80s, even. I like to think of myself as a kid of the 90s, but I was there for more than half of the 80s. And yeah, I remember that music video distinctly. They were, you know, changing in between skeleton puppets of themselves while they were playing.
Yep.
And I really dug that, but then I kind of fell off. I didn't really have a lot of exposure until more recently. A friend of mine plays in a Grateful Dead cover band around the city, and I've gone to a couple of the shows. Yeah. And it's a really fun time. Just the way they sort of build big jam sessions into their songs is kind of brilliant for live performance in a way that I never really realized. When you hear the stories and stuff, it's like, yeah, I guess so. But then when you're actually there, it's like every performance is a little different, and you can, like, really get in on the jams, and sometimes they're a lot more than you would expect. That being said, I don't know a bunch of their albums, and I don't know a whole lot of their history and stuff.
I'm no Deadhead either. My first experience was also the music video for Touch of Grey, which was obviously captivating to a young boy's mind to see skeletons dancing around a stage turning into men. And it was just a catchy song. You know, I knew of their reputation as this, like, acid head jam band. And then, of course, when I went to college and hung around with the potheads, there was always some Grateful Dead around. But there was also, unfortunately, a lot of Dave Matthews. So I really associate Grateful Dead with people that also like Dave Matthews and Fish. So that's not a good association for me either.
I like Fish. And I like the Grateful Dead as well. Yeah, Touch of Grey. It's actually one of the first music videos I showed my children. I have many children. I don't know if this has come up, but they've all seen that video at very young ages. And even today I showed the older three. I said, do you remember this one? And, you know, as young children, they used to get a kick of the dog running off with, I think it was Mickey Hart's leg. It's a great little video. And it was their most commercial top 40 hit. Yeah, certainly around forever, and everything you guys said.
Strikes me as an odd fit for the show, too, knowing that presumably going to have these like two little short song segment. I was very curious to see what they were going to play, how they were going to play it, things like that.
Shall we jump right into the show now that we've talked for a while?
Let's do it.
All right. So our cold open, Lorraine Newman is playing a reporter, and she's at the campaign headquarters of Dennis V. Hunkler, a Democratic candidate for Senate, I believe, and this his headquarters is at the Ramada Inn. Hunkler is known as a candidate who divorced his wife to marry a campaign staffer who turned out to be a minor. This is the first time ever in that precinct that the Democrats finished third behind the Republicans and the American Socialists. Bill Murray takes the podium. He's playing Dennis Hunkler, and he's there to give his concession speech. Behind him are Jane and Gilda and Brian Doyle Murray and Alan Zweibel, cheering on Bill as he makes this speech. So he thanks his new girlfriend, which is Gilda. She looks to be a quote-unquote loose woman. And then he thanks Garrett, who is one of his staffers, who brought in Coretta Scott King, the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who Bill's character then accidentally punched in the stomach because he didn't recognize her. Jane comes up as Betty Crane, who smooths some things over with one of the opponents that he called a illegal alien. Bill admits that raise taxes sky high is not a good campaign slogan or promise. Bill also apologizes for spending 4 months of the campaign period fulfilling his pledge to walk the state. He then reveals it is Montana, which is a very sparsely populated state. He says he'll be back in 2 years to run again. We then go back to Lorraine, who gives a rare live from New York. I thought this was really funny. I also noticed that a lot of these things that were like huge scandals for Dennis V. Hunkler seem to be forgivable sins these days. Referring to a opponent as an illegal alien brought me back to the folks that were demanding Obama's birth certificate. All the other things that come up in his campaign don't seem to be such a huge scandals as they might have been in 1978, and I don't know if that's for the better. I laughed through this, thought everyone was pretty darn good, and punching the widow of my MLK in the stomach because he didn't recognize her. I mean, how would you ever come back from that? So this was a good one.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed this as well. Bill Murray's the quintessential perfection of hapless buffoon when he's playing, like, he doesn't realize he's an idiot. And just sells it so well. His slightly confused apologies to each thing, like he didn't realize he was doing anything really that bad, but then people responded so poorly. I just thought it was great. And also just the name Hunkler, it's fun to hear, it's fun to say. Whoever came up with that one in the writing room, bravo.
I also enjoyed the cold open. I thought Bill was fantastic in this character. He could play this character in a movie. This could go for 90 minutes. My favorite part was definitely Gilda with that wig and chewing the gum behind him. It just kept me cracking up. And the only thing of note is that whenever I see Lorraine as a reporter, I wish she was still that weirdo spaced out reporter that sounds kind of like Trisha Takanawa.
I wrote that down. I said, I don't think Matt's going to like that this is not Lorraine's old reporter.
I don't know why she dropped it. Interesting character. But anyway, great cold open. Bill was awesome.
This is in the middle of, just after the midterm elections in the States. So there's a bit of election humor coming up that kind of threw me there. I forget how big it is down there, the midterms, because we don't have them in Canada. We're now off to the monologue. As soon as Buck Henry comes out the door and starts going down the steps, the crowd is electric, and that made me really excited. As the show goes on, I start to realize they're maybe not there to see the show. They're there for the dead. Anyway, Buck comes down the steps. He says he's happy to be back. He says that SNL is the best people in the world to work with, and they're all dear friends. And he starts talking about leading their comic sense and the comic sense of the show. Buck pretty much goes into some double talk with some random thoughts about comedy as an art form. The crawl comes up and it identifies itself as a crawl. The crawl says that the writers and the staff are all tired from the Steve Martin show. But because Buck is low key, very low key, they sort of see Buck as somewhere between a show and a week off. They then say Carrie Fisher will be hosting next week, and they're very excited, and they've already started working on that one. So they basically ignored their job this week because Buck, you know. It then cuts to clips of Star Wars with the music playing over Buck talking. The staff then asks the audience to chime in on their ideas for some sketches. There's Star Wars, Car Wars, and Star Bores. And Star Wars is about boring celebrities, and they realize mid-crawl that that would have been a good one for Buck. They then ask the audience to contribute their own ideas or voice their opinions on sketches that they've suggested. They give an address. They don't know the zip code, but they say you can get it from the post office. This is another visit to the Buck Henry talks, and they completely demean Buck via Crawl or Chiron. It still works. Maybe not as funny as it has. The addition of the Star Wars clips with the music playing, and it's just the shooting and all that sort of stuff was really, really funny. Who else would do this but Buck? So thumbs up on this monologue for me.
Yeah, I would agree. Not the first time we've seen it, as you've mentioned. And there is a little part of me that does kind of wish we could give Buck a little more room to work himself. This is more of a joke that they've framed around him rather than a joke that he seems to actively perform. And I've seen him do some really funny stuff in the monologues before, but it still totally works. The Star Wars line gave me a good stupid laugh. And when they full on just superimposed Star Wars over top of him, like they eventually like gave him a little corner in the screen, but right out of the gate, they faded in the scene of Star Wars over. I laughed really hard at that too. So yeah, it works. It was good.
I think this was my favorite one of these yet. I certainly liked it more than the others. Interesting to note that when they were going through the credits, there was a big pop for the dead. So the crowd is definitely there for the dead. I thought this was really, really funny that there's no pressure to do a great show and it's kind of a week off. And they start playing Star Wars, and then Mark's right when they squeezed him up into this tiny little inset in the top corner, just his little head. And then I was watching Star Wars, which was kind of fun. It was kind of nostalgic watching like a grainy VHS version of Star Wars. And Star Wars, it's got to be like a real movie by now, surely. Slight disagreement, I guess, with Mark. I thought Buck performed the hell out of this. He was smooth. He was going without hesitation. Like his performance in the background, I noticed just how he was killing it behind it. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Because you do see like some of the hosts that are the hardest to watch are the ones who take themselves too seriously. The fact that he's willing to just take this giant dump on himself is really it's a good sign for how he gets along with everyone.
We now go to the Home Chinchilla Ranch. I don't know this for sure, but I'm assuming this is an Aykroyd piece. Dan Aykroyd plays Lane Brether. He's a spokesperson with a new home profit enterprise. It's the Rovco Chinch Ranch. It's a home chinchilla breeding ranch, so you can raise and breed chinchillas and make your own coats in your home. It comes with 2 5-week-old chinchillas, a male and a female, a chinchilla high-rise, and a Chinch King harvester. Dan then says, "You may be thinking I could never skin a chinchilla." And he throws it to 2 home ranchers who show how quick and easy it is to skin a live chinchilla with the Chinch King harvester. Cut to Bill, who takes a chinch out of the high-rise box, and along with his partner Lorraine, they put it in the harvester and flick a button. Fur comes out one side, like a chinchilla pelt comes out one side, and meat comes out the other. They then show Lorraine using a sewing machine to fashion pelts together to form a coat. The meat is fit for human consumption. And they eat a burger where Lorraine gives the line, "Wow, that's great chinch." You also get 2 books with 100 fur patterns and 20 ways to prepare a chinch for $18.95. Dan signs off with the tagline, "It's a cinch to ranch a chinch with Rovco." This feels like the first time in a long time we've seen this sort of thing from Dan. It very well may not be, but this one really threw me back to those excellent ones from seasons 1 and 2. Idea is hilarious. Everything was being done at home, like for the first time in the 70s. You could do stuff at home, and imagining, you know, raising and killing chinchillas with this big coffee urn looking thing was hilarious to me. This was very, very funny. I thought Dan was brilliant. Bill and Lorraine were great. And the nice little production bits. I don't think the meat came out the way they wanted it to, but the pelt certainly did. I got a kick out of this. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this was well written, well executed. It was a lot of fun. Mildly uncomfortable in like a way that makes you laugh a little harder. I don't know if you've ever seen a chinchilla live, but they're actually pretty cute. So when Bill pulled a real one out, it just, I don't know, made it hit home just how sort of dark the whole enterprise would be. And I popped like a mark when Lorraine dropped the line, that's good chinch. Like that really tied it in to those older commercials for me. And yeah, it felt like a return to form. In a sort of way.
This is one of my favorite commercial parodies in a while. It was terrifying. Chinch sounds like something I shouldn't be allowed to say, and I'm not even comfortable saying it out loud. But Dan is so good as these morally bankrupt capitalist salesmen, much like Mark. I got quite a rise out of Lorraine. Doing the throwback to the Great Bass mm-hmm. on the Bass-O-Matic. I could never skin a chinchilla, so this would be the product for me.
We're now off to Samurai Optometrist. This is an Alan's Y. Bell piece. When the audience realizes what we're about to see, there's a huge reaction, almost Grateful Dead worthy. So Buck comes in as Mr. Dantley. He has broken glasses. The samurai can't replace the glasses, so Dantley asks for new ones. Samurai Futaba mimes that it will cost an arm and a leg. In order to get Buck's eyes tested, Samurai Futaba pulls out a sword. It has a little light at the bottom used to test the eyes. He gets Buck to read out the eye chart. Buck then calls Samurai Futaba an optician, which makes Samurai want to commit seppuku. He then realizes he should have said optometrist. Buck talks about not being able to do the crossword puzzle, so he and his wife have to lay in bed together, and Samurai does the old pump the sword thing, the sex gesture. Buck wants to know if he can get lenses that are shatterproof. Futaba has a pair of lenses there and he chops them and the table falls apart and the lenses are good. Dantley then says he wants tortoise shell frames. So Samurai Futaba pulls out a tortoise, throws it up in the air, cuts it with a sword, picks up the frames, and they're perfectly cut out of the tortoise shell. Buck says he wants bifocals. The samurai starts to swing the sword towards Buck's face, and they hit a freeze frame. Okay, the samurai, like a lot of the recurring sketches, is starting to get Pavlovian, where people are buying in before the sketch even starts. You know, people were just liking it because it was the samurai. That being said, I actually thought this was probably the best of all the samurai sketches we've seen to date. I found Belushi to be very subdued in this one. And it works. There were some good bits, the arm and the leg, the sword, the sword on the light, the sword as the cane, the tortoise shell. I really thought this was far better than any of the samurais we saw before. I think it has to do with more sight gags. Belushi was not screaming the whole time. I found that the fake Japanese was just gibberish. It didn't sound Japanese to me. I don't know why I liked this one more than any other samurai, but I actually did kind of enjoy this. Certainly Buck being there doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. As soon as I saw the samurai, I was kind of just like, all right, here we go. And once again, always proud of Buck to get back in the saddle after that time he had his head split open by the sword, especially with that finish, letting Belushi like swing at his eyes like that. He's a brave fella. Gets himself in the line of fire for comedy. I think you're right when you say Belushi was a little more subdued and like the physical comedy came through a little more. He was less like just big and loud and a little more like when he did the arm and the leg gesture. And there was another one. I forget exactly what it was that like got me. It wasn't like my favorite skit of the night for sure. But as far as the samurai skit goes, I liked a lot better than I was expecting to going into it.
So I saw the storefront. I knew the samurai was coming up, kind of a quick, easy read. And you're right. He was more subdued. And I did think the light gag was cute when he had it at the end of the dagger. But I still don't like it. It's just, it really has the same old thing kind of vibe for me. I feel like I've seen it before. And I didn't think the audience loved it either. I didn't hear a lot of big laughs or anything I noticed while I was watching. I thought it was plotting. I didn't like it. See, everything's been great so far. I like things, yeah. But I didn't like this.
Gentlemen, you ready for this next one?
Oh, I guess.
Since we've started this podcast, I've been wondering how this was going to sit with you folks. Let's talk about Uncle Roy. This was written by Rosie Schuster and Ann Beats. So Dan and Jane play a set of parents leaving to see a movie. Jane says she wants to see Foul Play because she wants to see that new young comedian who falls down a lot. That new young comedian was, of course, none other than Chevy Chase. Foul Play came out in July of 78. Yeah, Dan's character, the father, has some reservations about letting Roy, a 45-year-old bachelor with nothing to do but babysit, come over and babysit. Jane defends him and says the children love him. In comes Uncle Roy, played by Buck Henry. Gilda and Lorraine come down as two children, Tracy and Terry, and they are two kids who absolutely adore Uncle Roy. The parents leave, and the two girls play Buried Treasure, wherein they have to find presents that are hidden in his one of his front pockets, and it's a pack of jujubes. They then ask for a magic trick, and he shows a nickel and a dime, and he makes them disappear. Gilda's, I think, is on her shoulder. Lorraine's is somewhere near her lap. The girls are excited, and they say that they can do magic and make their faces disappear, and they pull up their nightgowns to reveal their underwear, and Roy takes a photo. Roy then remembers it's wash day, and he tells the girls to bring down all their dirty clothes, and he's very excited as the girls are bringing down their dirty clothes. He tells the girls that they can polish the banister by sliding down, and he watches from a very awkward angle as Lorraine slides down the banister. Jane then comes home, having forgotten her purse. When she sees the laundry in Buck's hand, she says he's just too good. Buck tells her to make sure she has everything so she doesn't have to come back. Buck then gets the girls to play horsey by having them ride the arms of the couch. They want Roy to be the horse, but he'd rather just watch, so he takes more photos. They then play Ruffy, the dog, and in this one, Roy is a dog, and the girls have him sit up and beg, and they start spanking him for going up on the couch. The phone rings. The parents are coming home because they missed the movie. The girls ask Roy why he hasn't been married, and he says his wife probably hasn't been born yet. The girls then go up to bed. Uncle Roy, I want to hear from you guys first because I have some other info about the sketch, but I'd like to know where you guys are. This is definitely the dodgiest sketch we've come across so far.
I mean, only Buck could get away with this if get away with it he did. It's a bit of a rough watch, and the way they keep pushing it, the more uncomfortable you get, the more you're hoping for something to laugh, to break the tension. And I did actually have a pretty good laugh at the way Buck delivered the line, my future wife probably hasn't even been born yet. Like, yeah. I laughed at that. It was pretty rough. Although I will say Dan at the very start as the grumpy husband who wanted to get going to the movies because he didn't want to miss the start. I don't know. Something about that made me chuckle. It was just so slice of life true, like it felt real. Yeah. Outside of that, though, this was pretty rough and definitely not something to be getting away with today.
No.
You know what I think makes this sketch and what really fucking sold it for me, and Dan's concern was immediately validated as soon as he walks in wearing that hat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That hat just sells the whole character for me. Uh-huh. Lorraine and Gilda fucking doing awesome voices, and they did keep escalating, and I thought it was funny. I laughed a lot. Buck was he was so giddy. He was like that old man on the Family Guy. They shouted out one of my favorite old candy certs. So that was nice for me. Well, the other thing I noticed about the sketch, other than, yes, I did find it really funny, Lorraine was having a blast doing this. She looked like she was having the time of her life.
First off, it was excellently performed. Anyone who is doubting that this was not excellently performed is essentially someone who is so overwhelmed by the subject matter for good reasons or whatever, that they can't see how good everyone was in this. So here's the background. Rosie Schuster had a babysitter who used to tell her the bad things he used to do. Like, not, he wasn't like a sexual deviant in any way, shape or form, but he used to tell her like all the problems he'd cause for people and the trouble he'd get in and stuff like that. Rosie has defended this sketch by saying the girls had so much fun and were unscathed by Uncle Roy's perversions. Others have also said that it made parents more aware of a legitimate issue. Like, there were far more Janes in the world than there were Dans. And I think Dan's existence almost justifies the sketch in a way. The issue with this sketch, a lot of it comes down with your philosophy of sketches, right? And your philosophy of what these things are. Like, within the sketch, there's no danger. But like outside of the sketch, if these people continue on in a universe, there's a lot of danger. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like they're not carrying it through to a point where there's actual harm caused. They're just insinuating that it's possible in that universe otherwise.
Yeah. Like, if the universe ends when the sketch ends, it's a philosophy of how do you see fiction? Is there object permanence in fiction, I guess, is kind of a way to refer to it, you know? At the time, and this is very much an at the time thing, escalation was not as well known, nor were a lot of facts and subjects about, you know, lasting implications of all this sort of stuff. I definitely cringe watching this sketch, but I also laugh.
They perform it like super over the top, which I think helps. And, you know, the fact that the girls are so deliriously enjoying the time and company, I do think softens it up a bit. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty evil. Come on.
Yes.
It's quite evil. You couldn't put it on the television today. I don't think you could have put it on the television 20 years ago.
Well, I'm surprised even then, you know, it made it past censors. It made it past the network. It made it past everyone in the writer's room. It's taking Buck's perversions to a new low.
Yeah. It does a good job right out of the gate. Like, even like you said, when he walks in with the hat, but even the way he's walking and the face, and there's like a tone in his voice that just screams creepy. He nails it so well. And yeah. It's, you know, there's no moment in the skit where you think, oh, poor Uncle Roy.
No.
Oh, Uncle Roy has a point. You know, the whole time he's like, ah, this guy is such a fucking creep. God, where's that chinchilla machine? I could probably fit him in there if I pushed hard enough.
Yeah.
I'm not mad that they made the sketch. It did make me a little uncomfortable to watch, but sometimes that's what gets the good laugh out of you. You know, you build a tension and you create this discomfort, so you're looking for something to laugh at to get over it.
There's two more Uncle Roys yet to come. Is that surprising?
A little bit.
Yeah, definitely a little bit. Although, like you guys said, they are having so much fun with it. I can see how they would keep pushing it until someone tells them they found the line, you know?
Yeah. You know, someone made a point on a message board or a post about this sketch that if one parent got home late and watched this and thought, Jesus, that Uncle Roy reminds me a lot of that guy that we just had watching our kids, you know, that might have served its purpose. And there is one line at the end of, I think, the third Uncle Roy, which almost justifies the series. All right, let's talk about the Grateful Dead, formed in the mid-60s in California. They are basically a fusion of whatever they felt like. You guys talked about it, jam band into the counterculture. One of the most influential and popular bands in rock history, did their thing and they did it well for a very long time. And they have probably the most devoted fan base of any band. They were also known to be pretty excellent to their fans. Their most recent release, I think, was called Terrapin Station, released in July of 77. The albums did okay. The singles, not always. This song is called Casey Jones. It's very loosely based on the folktale. I always thought this was the most associated song with the band, although apparently other folks disagree. I love this song. I love the performance. I'm not a Deadhead, but I've never seen anything significant by the Grateful Dead that I didn't just thoroughly enjoy. I love the band's sound. Garcia's voice is really cool. I noticed a lot of people since then have tried to imitate his sound. They have some really nice harmonies, and they always seem to be enjoying themselves. Every time I hear the Grateful Dead, I'm like, I gotta listen to some more Grateful Dead, and this did not disappoint me at all. I loved it.
Yeah, this is a good time. Again, not a huge fan, but every time I hear them, I'm usually pretty happy that they're in my ears. They did seem like they're having a really good time. I really enjoyed, I think it was the bass player had a blue t-shirt on that had just "Hi Mom" sewn on the top right chest, which I thought was pretty cute. And I was actually kind of surprised that they would do Saturday Night Live. You know, like it seemed like maybe not something they would, like I could see why the show would want them on, given the history of booking we've witnessed. The fact that, you know, these guys are rock and roll with some counterculture and some drug relations and all that. Fairly mellow, but still with a little bit of distortion and stuff. I feel like this was a good choice. You know, if I was coming home from a Saturday night of having a nice time out with some friends and maybe getting into a little Jazz Cabbage and this came on, I'd be pretty happy guy in the late 70s.
Mark, since you've been here last, we've seen Devo, which was a really cool, wild, different performance. I loved it.
Yeah, Devo was a good performance too.
I didn't like this as much as you guys. Surprise, fucking surprise. First of all, this song is like old even by the time they're playing it on TV. Why are they playing this song? I don't understand that. Are they just like out there trying to play the hit, you know, a short reasonable song that somebody might know? I mean, maybe. I didn't like the song choice. I know this song, and it's like that and Touch of Grey are like the only two Grateful Dead songs I know. But this one I don't like so much. It's a little too, like, I don't know, rootsy or something for me. And I almost said it was a little too toe-tapping.
That doesn't make sense. That's what I was going to say, toe-tapping. I remember you got mad at me once for mentioning toe-tapping. So I left it But yeah, no, you're right. This is a toe-tapper.
It is a toe-tapper, and I think it might be, like, too rootsy, almost like there's a Southern California, yep. No, there's a feel to it of, like, sunny Americana. Anyway, I don't like it, but it's not bad. Don't get me wrong, it's not bad. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, I could listen, if this came on the radio, I wouldn't, like, freak out and turn it off like it was American Pie or something. But I was just so disappointed with the song choice is what I'm really trying to say. The other thing I noticed is that I just thought, and this has nothing to do with the song or the band, I just thought the sound was weird. Like, it was mixed poorly. It all sounded really thin to me. There's no low level. It wasn't rich. It wasn't a full sound. And that kept bugging me.
There is a weird sound stuff that pops up later, too. I wonder if there was sound issues that night.
I kind of did notice it seemed a little thin, too, like for such a big band. Like, they've got two full drum kits going and there's so many people there. It did seem, I think you're right there. There did seem something a little off in the mix.
Weekend Update brought to you by Chafe Boyardee. It's a ravioli that you sprinkle on itchy Italians. It begins with a story about Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat, and it says if they break up their peace talks at the Camp David Accord, their Nobel Prizes will go to either Rice of the Sox or Guidry of the Yankees. They were, I think, the contenders for MVP perhaps that year. I'm not sure. The census is being conducted, and Jane notes that one person is born every 10 seconds and one dies every 16 seconds. She welcomes the 60 new people and says those are the breaks to the 40 leaving. We then go to Celebrity Corner, and it is Bill Murray interviewing John Belushi as Elizabeth Taylor. Taylor is eating a chicken, a giant chicken leg, and she's being interviewed because her husband is in a tight Senate race in Virginia. All the jokes at the time were how Liz Taylor had gained weight and, quote unquote, let herself go. John, as Taylor says, she's going to be going on a diet. She then starts choking on a chicken, but Bill doesn't notice and keeps going with questions till Liz Heimlichs up the piece of chicken. Incidentally, her husband, John Warner, did win the seat, and he did hold it till 2009. So he had a nice run there as the senator from Virginia. The thumb of Jimmy Hoffa was found on Interstate 80 by someone who thought he was picking up a very small hitchhiker. Bill puts the thumb in his pocket, and he actually breaks a little bit. Seattle Slough, the racehorse, was impaled on a hurdle, and this is the least funniest horse photo that Mark and I have seen yet. A grant is being given by the Ford Foundation to develop a birth control device, which is an implant in a woman's hand. It's twice as effective as the diaphragm and will eventually prove that one in the hand is worth two in the bush. Dan comes in as the station manager, and he and Jane do a point counterpoint about the Shah of Iran. A lot of lines in there, some good stuff. Dan, instead of saying, "Jane, you ignorant slut," he calls her a poor, misguided scrag. This was a weaker weekend update than we've seen this season. John Belushi's Liz Taylor was kind of a weak celebrity corner. I know what they were going for. Really just a cheap laugh of heavyset Belushi playing Liz Taylor. Thought the intro was good. Some of the jokes were good. I thought the intro about Celebrity Corner was pretty good, talking about Liz Taylor being sort of a paragon of beauty. And I kind of forgotten that Belushi had done this, and I was expecting like Gilda or, well, wouldn't have been Lorraine that quick, but probably Gilda coming in. Also noted Belushi hated doing drag. That birth control joke, the two in the hand is worth one in the hand is worth two in the bush, or two in the hand is worth one in the bush, or whatever it was really funny for me. But all things considered, I thought this was our weakest weekend update this season.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty flat. I did enjoy the stupid thumb, like Bill Murray having his own thumb in the box, and how much he was enjoying that stupid joke. Like that was good. And yeah, the one in the hand worth two in the bush, that got a really good laugh out of me. The point counterpoint was all right as well. Jane's delivery is great as usual, but she just doesn't have a lot of material to work with. And I was wondering if it was her, the writing. And then when she got to that one joke, that got me, and I laughed as hard as I did. I was like, all right, it's the rest of the writing for me. She gets a pass.
Jane's new haircut makes her look older. The way she has this, like, almost like these layers now with the waves. I really thought the ravioli thing that you put on Itchy Italians was really funny. I thought that was really funny. And I thought John Belushi was kind of funny, the way he just didn't give a shit about what Bill was saying. Uh-huh. And he was just checked out. Bill laughing at the thumb, yeah, pretty good. But I mean, you guys were right, though. It was a weak counterpoint, and there was really nothing else going on. I did laugh at Belushi, and the thumb was funny, but that was it, and it seemed to go on for a while. That's what, mm-hmm. two jokes? That's a bad ratio.
Yeah. We now have Lorraine as Jean Marsh, our host, welcomes us to Great Performances, where we're going to see part 5 of The Tale of Rasputin. Lorraine has a lot of wordiness here, and there's some flubs in there. There's something going on off camera with the cue cards, or Lorraine was making some mistakes here, but this kind of went strange. I don't usually see Lorraine reading the cue cards, but this was definitely, maybe, I don't know, it was wordy or something. John Belushi plays Steve Bouchakis as Rasputin. He's in St. Petersburg. Buck, Gilda, and Dan are playing servants, and they serve Rasputin some poison cakes. Rasputin dies, the servants are happy, but then Rasputin wakes up and runs away. Aykroyd shoots him, and he falls, and everybody is happy, and Rasputin wakes up again. All three then shoot him, and again he wakes up. They beat him with fireplace sticks and a couple of other things. They beat him a lot. They take a break, and then they beat him again. Then they blow him up with dynamite, and again he wakes up. They then throw him out a window of the 6th floor, and he comes back, and there's a freeze frame. We then go back to Jean Marsh, who talks about the next episode, and we see a clip of part 6 where Rasputin has an arrow through the head and an axe in his head, and he's getting bitten by Gilda on the leg or the foot. We're then told it's brought to us by a grant from Chemtrex. I was really disappointed. I saw this years ago, and I thought it was way better than it was. There was just, I didn't laugh at any point except when they were beating him for a long time and they took a little break and breathed and then hit him again. I didn't like it.
I gotta disagree with you myself. I think this is like based on a true story. I think the assassination of Rasputin, they did,
yeah,
jacked with a ludicrous amount of poison, and it didn't do anything, so they just shot him anyway. So,
yeah, they tried to kill him a bunch of ways, yeah.
Yeah, and so just the way the escalations, this felt almost to me like a live-action Looney Tunes cartoon. I feel like maybe having seen this more times, it doesn't hit as well. I could see how it wouldn't hit as well in the second time, because I didn't know what was coming next, and the way they just kept adding to it, like the part where they... they stuffed the dynamite in him and ran around the couch, and Dan Aykroyd picks up a couple of the broken pieces of the table from earlier to shield him and Gilda from the dynamite that's like a foot and a half away on the other side of a couch. I don't know. There was something really stupid about it. I will say this was a stupid sketch, but it worked for me. I think we've established stupid sometimes is my favorite. And it's just like the slapstick over the top and the way they kept announcing like in a different epithet, like finally this insane madman finally rushes free from this lunatic monk. And then he'd come back screaming. I don't know. I had a really good time with this. And I thought the over the top performances and the way they were really selling it, it worked really well for me. I had a few laughs.
Good.
I didn't get any laughs out of it. I did think the pummeling behind the couch for a while was funny, and like that way Family Guy will beat a joke into the ground and then you're like, wow, I'm still watching Waylon Jennings sing, and the absurdity just kind of refreshes it somehow, even though it's just been going on this whole time. But this other than that, making me think of Family Guy and something that I actually find funny, I didn't think this worked at all. And despite Lorraine messing up her lines a little bit, it was kind of nice to see her get to do a bit of a character like this, which is rare. She seemed like she'd be pretty good at it.
Did you notice though the Lorraine's cue card business, like there was something happening there, wasn't it? Were they changing them too quickly, or
I don't know. It was pretty odd for her to like kind of be stumbling over the words like that. It must have been something.
Yeah. You could definitely see her eyes doing some gymnastics at one point around one of the flubs. Seemed like there was something else going on, like it wasn't business as usual. But again, hard to say for real.
We're now off to Nick Sands, and of this, these are all written by Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Tom Davis, Paul Schaefer. Marilyn Miller was in on a few too early on, I think. We're at the Nevada Highway 278, I think a small bar on the highway. Nick starts by singing "The Horse with No Name." He introduces himself, and then he goes to Bill Kreutzmann and John Belushi sitting there as John and Cliff. He then starts singing "Shaft." Paul Schaefer jumps in with some goofy backgrounds as Bill's about to swear. Bill then tells Earl the bartender, played by Garrett, to give John and Bill a round of beers. There's a bit of repartee in here about there being several owners of the establishment. John and Cliff mention that they work at a gypsum mine, and Nick jumps into working in a gypsum mine. Nick then goes over to Gilda and Lorraine, who are cheating on their husbands with Buck, who apparently is something of a gigolo. Dan comes in as Jimmy Joe Red Sky. He has a snake that he ran over. Last call comes early because they're outside of the alcohol zoning area, and Nick forcefully pushes everyone out. To me, this might have been the worst Nick the Lounge Singer. This felt really, really flat and really clumsy. Bill was definitely not as energetic as he usually was. And there wasn't that fun and goofy interaction that we get in the other Nick ones.
Well, I mean, it is a Buck Henry episode, so you can't blame them for taking the week off a little bit, right?
Well, I started to wonder how true that might have been.
Yeah, it felt like it in this skit. It was definitely downbeat. I said earlier, Murray plays an excellent hapless buffoon, and he's supposed to kind of be annoying. But when like the energy's not there and there's not a lot of jokes written in the script, his heel work as this buffoon is entertaining. When all that other stuff is falling flat, he's kind of more obnoxious than normal. So yeah, I don't know. This was fine. It didn't make me want to turn off my TV, but it did make me wonder what was in my fridge for a minute.
It's one of those weeks, lads, where I'm just like playing the old opposite game. I thought this was good. I thought Bill was great. Belushi was good as the trucker. I thought Buck was good. Yeah, I didn't get a lot of like the laugh out louds from it, sure. And I guess now that you mention it, the energy was a little more subdued from Bill. But I still thought that he played the character super well, if not slightly more serious, but in a way that I found weirdly convincing, like when he was shooing everybody out, like just kind of like a business Mr. Business side. I thought it was good. I really just think it's funny whenever he sings.
We're now off to More Flu to Worry About, which is a takeoff of More Insects to Worry About. And we have the return of Dr. Ike Badanza. We saw him in More Insects when he talked about the art-loving bugs. And Jane, of course, back as Joan Face. And as we might recall, these two were supposed to hook up at the end of that episode. Joan Face asks about the rise of new flus in the 80s, and experts think that whole populations are going to be wiped out. Buck is really sick of people who are just into the mild flus, and he likes the really big flus. He likes to study and talk about those, such as the toad flu, where everything sort of it gets backed up and then is reconsumed and backed up again until you explode. Joan mentions that her aunt had it. The other one that he decided to talk about in depth is the Australian flu. It's a flu that can't wait to leave Australia and get into the human body and basically be a tourist in your body. There are three characters known of. We have Lana Cantrell, Olivia Newton-John, and Helen Reddy, I believe all Australian performers. And whenever they do a club date, there's an uptake in cases. Buck thinks Australia is stupid because it's a continent that only has one country. There are a whole bunch of one-liners in there about the Australian flu as how it travels around the body. I certainly didn't have the love for it that I had of the insect ones. I think so much fun could be had with diseases, and they just didn't get it. That being said, Jane and Buck always work well together, and it's a nice sort of follow-up to the insect ones I liked.
Yeah, this one for me was a real mixed bag. It started off pretty strong. I was kind of excited because I did like that insect one, and the back and forth between Jane and Buck is always a good time. And the way, I don't know why, but the way he said that, I'm so sick of people who aren't into, who are just into the small flus, that really got me for some reason. Also, the Australia being a country and a continent thing, being stupid to him, really made me laugh. But outside of that, they just really rode that Australian tourism bug joke for too long. Tried too many different angles, and I don't know if I was missing something or it's just not a great joke, but it did feel like they really liked it and they wrote it way too hard, and it did not work for me. So yeah, there's a couple of real peaks amongst mostly valleys for me was this one.
I pretty much agree with everything you just said, except for the fact that I liked it a little more. I think you're spot on with that Australia business, but first of all, the title of the show is just hilarious. And I really like the character of Joan Face.
Joan Face.
There's nothing to like about her as a character. It's just Jane. I just love that she is this weird fake talk lady. Jane casually suggesting that maybe you can get the Australian flu from going to see Greece was really funny. Yeah. She said it with earnest. So yeah, definitely liked it more than you guys, but it was a little rambly at times. Mm-hmm. But I laughed more than I have at several other parts of the show. So
very good. Grateful Dead come back out, and Bob Weir takes lead vocals, and they do "I Need a Miracle" and "Good Lovin'." Good Lovin's a cover. I know the Young Rascals version much better. And I read that this version was actually panned by critics, but I kind of enjoyed it. And a couple of long shots show the audience was digging it too. I just liked this. I mean, I don't have much else to say about it. It was a lot of fun, and I'm not a huge fan of the Young Rascals, but I thought this was pretty darn good. I liked it.
Yeah, I was tapping the shit out of my toes for this segment. It was good. No one's reinventing the wheel. They seem to be having a good time. The music was upbeat. Nothing special, but I enjoyed it.
It still sounds thin. First of all, I liked these songs better than I liked the first song. Just a little more energy. And yeah, I thought Good Lovin' was awesome. That was my favorite part of, I guess, the three songs. So I liked them like 3-2-1, I guess, would be my informal ranking. Bob Weir was fun to watch. He was pretty into it. I'm not a convert. I'm not going to go pursue more Grateful Dead based on this performance. I liked it better than I have mathematically, I'm sure, liked Saturday Night Live performances. I don't know what I expected. Maybe I don't know the Grateful Dead enough and was expecting something a little more psychedelic. Mm-hmm. Not even psychedelic though, but like even a little day trippy. I don't know. It was much more rootsy than I expected, which was a little bit of a disappointment for me, but maybe that's just who they are. But based on this performance, I'm not going to go find out.
We now go to St. Mickey's KOC. This is written by Brian Doyle Murray. And this is a KOC lodge meeting. Belushi plays the newly elected Grand Knight. At first, I thought it might have been Larry Farber, but it's not. It's just a character similar to the old Larry Farber. Buck comes in as the priest and he blesses the council. John introduces the past Grand Knight of 40 plus years as an old man who's sleeping. He introduces Bill Murray as his son Jocko and Garrett as guest speaker, former baseball player Chico Escuela. Dan comes up as Jack Niehauser, Deputy Grand Knight, tells a really bad bowling joke, and then he goes through some financials and mentions that Chico's fee and the dinner itself has put the club further in debt. Jane and Gilda come out as the kitchen girls for a round of applause, and then Chico is to give his motivational speech where he says, "Baseball has been very, very good to me." And he was given $900 for that speech. And then they call him back up and he says, keep your eye on the ball. Bill then comes up as John's son Jocko, makes fun of Chico by saying gracias. We get some closing remarks and a joke from Buck Henry as the priest about a young man who died in the middle of sex with a lady. This sketch is way too real. My father was a member of the KOC. I'm on a few similar clubs in my local town. This was basically an actual meeting. A bit too real. And if this audience is filled with deadheads, it's definitely not the crowd for this sketch at all. Highlight, of course, is Garrett's Chico Escuela goes on to become a regular Weekend Update character. The reins, I think, are tossed over to Alan Zweibel. Becomes one of Garrett's most memorable character, actually. The jokes that I laughed at are probably as much to do with the fact that I was at a meeting exactly like this last night. So, I don't know where you guys are sitting. I enjoyed it. I liked Chico. But it was definitely flat, slow, quiet, and for a certain type.
Not really a member of any sort of societies as such, but my grandfather was a member of the KOC, so I spent quite a bit of time when I was a younger kid at events that were similar to this. And yes, this was extremely real, very well executed. I don't know. There's a lot of little things going on in the background, too, just the way, like, Bill Murray being the sort of shitheel son, like mugging and making faces the whole time. And the way like Dan very earnestly breaks down their whole budget and this $900 speaking fee dwarfs everything else they've done. And the setup for Garrett to just get up and say one line of poorly broken English, the tension and the slowness and the almost boring arrow to the room vibe that they were nailing that felt really real just made that pop so hard for me. Like, I laughed really hard when Bill came back around to mimic Garrett when he got up to say some words, and it just fits so well with him being such a little shitheel. Like, this felt like a real world. Like, I don't know, I like this a lot more than I think I should have. I don't think it's as good as I found it.
We're influenced by having sat through these things.
Yeah.
The straightness with which it's performed, I really appreciate as well. They're not playing it like it's even supposed to be funny. They all just seem to kind of disappear into their characters. And I think it was very well put together and done. And as Mark mentioned, the fact that Garrett is putting them desperately in the hole and he's just sitting there smiling and smoking his thin cigar and probably not even listening. Very funny. So, and Bill was funny. I got a kick out of it. Indeed.
You know, it's made all the better by the fact we can see all the other KOC members in the front. It's all filled with, like,
the way they're positioned around the table, so you can see, like, you're looking at a couple bags of heads, but you can also see a lot of them are turned so you can see their faces. Yeah, it does make it feel like you're sitting in the room with them.
Yeah, yeah. All right, and we go to the good nights. Not much to mention here. The Grateful Dead's up there. Everybody seems pretty happy together. Dan and Lorraine and I think Garrett head off early. As does Bob Weir as well. I think he follows Lorraine backstage. So let's rate the host. For me, Buck Henry, not his best, not his worst. It was a little disappointing because a lot of the stuff Buck did, certainly not Uncle Roy, but a lot of the stuff Buck did, anyone could have done.
Yeah, I don't know. Not Buck's best, but I don't know if it's his worst. I probably haven't seen his worst. I think I've gotten a third to half of his performances so far. So thank you, fellas. Even Buck on a bad day is still better than half the people I've seen try to do this so far. And he did seem to be, like, really happy to be there. He was having fun. Like, even during that KOC sketch when he came up as the father at the end for the really dark turn of talking about this kid dying, like freezing to death. And then the line where he didn't think the kid had enough time to make a perfect repentance or whatever. Like, he's not just talking about this kid being dead. He's talking about this kid going to hell.
Yeah.
And he delivers it so straight. And so, like, the way his eyes drop to the floor as he's saying it, like, almost like he's getting lost in his own thoughts. I think he was on tonight. Maybe yeah. Some of the material that gave him one of the best, but I think he did a great job with what he had, and he had way too much fun as Uncle Roy. That looks like maybe his favorite thing he's ever done for these guys.
I think, yeah, you guys are right. He showed up, you know, he had good energy. He was happy to be there. He's perfectly capable, and I thought he was great in everything he was in. I have no issues with him as host. You know, I didn't like everything, but that's not on him. That Buck was awesome.
Music, excellent. I loved both sets, three songs. I thought they were fantastic. Again, it's like every time I hear the Grateful Dead, I'm like, I gotta put more on, and then I forget to. So maybe this time is the charm, but I thought they were fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty low bar to clear with the music choices that have been happening, but I think they soared over it for me. I really enjoyed it. Not the best performance that I've seen to date, but up there for me. I really dug this.
Maybe I just don't like the Grateful Dead. Maybe my expectation. Maybe I want them to be Pink Floyd. But I mean, Pink Floyd or Pink Floyd. I could just go listen to Pink Floyd. And because, as I've already mentioned, so not to beat it to death, it was rootsier and a little more Americana than I was expecting, mm-hmm. and not as cool and psychedelic as I was expecting. But it's not adding it to my Spotify, and I thought the sound levels or something were off, and they sounded kind of crummy.
Yeah, actually, it was during the Nick sketch where the sound went weird, too. So what was your worst sketch of the night, fellas?
Well, my worst sketch of the night was probably the samurai sketch. It was just the same old shit for me. I don't like the character. And, you know, you mentioned they tried something different. I still didn't think it was funny. And they just got to move on. Write something new already. And yeah, as I mentioned when we were talking about it, I really, if you go back and watch it, I didn't think the audience liked it.
Yeah, I'd be with you there. It's the best samurai sketch I've seen yet, but it's still a samurai sketch. So it was a little better than what I'm used to, but it still wasn't good. And maybe I sold it shorter with my expectations as soon as I saw it was a samurai sketch. But either way, I wasn't a big fan, so I'm with you there.
It was definitely more flu to worry about. It just wasn't as good as the insect ones. And I didn't get as much of a laugh out of the flu one as I had out of a lot of sketches tonight, even though I think it was a weak night of sketches. So what was the best sketch, fellas?
My favorite sketch of the night was the chinchillas, to seeing little chinchillas murdered for their nice soft fur. I always liked Dan's scumbag salesman, and this is the best one they've done in a while. It's one of the things that got me into the show in the first place. So I'm always going to like them. I'm always going to like a grisly fake ad that is low key horrifying.
I completely agree that is the best sketch of the night, written, performed, executed. Technically speaking, it's the best. But I think my favorite was actually that stupid Rasputin sketch. Oh, I don't know why. It was so dumb. But that's what got for me, man. I don't know. Maybe I'm just really tired. But I get why people wouldn't like it, because it was really dumb. But I laughed more than I should have. It just kept escalating, and it got real cartoonish, and it reminded me of watching like Looney Tunes when I was a kid. The way they were beating them and ran out of breath and then started again. They're getting the dynamite, they're throwing them out the window, nothing's working. That's my favorite.
I've enjoyed listening to you talk about Rasputin more than I like the sketch. Matt, I'm with you for every reason you said. Chinchilla Ranch. Who was the star of the night, fellas?
It's pretty tough because, as you said, it was a weak night of sketches. So as I sit here and mull it over,
I guess it's like I really like Dan and the Chinchilla sketch. It was my favorite of the night. Lorraine got to do a few things, even though she was flubbing her lines. I thought she played a kind of a weirdo host character. Was good in the Chinchilla sketch. She was good in the Uncle sketch. But I really liked Bill Murray's lounge singer, and he was good in the Knights of Columbus sketch. He's really improving on Update. I didn't really notice Dan after the Chinchilla sketch a whole lot. I know he was in that Russian sketch in that hideous blue shirt. Yes, it was Lorraine. I'm going to say Lorraine Newman. I noticed her the most, and I enjoyed her performances the most.
Very good.
I agree there was a lot of, like, little bits where, like, Lorraine and Bill were sticking out, but this is going to be a rare Belushi one for me. He put a lot of work into this episode. The samurai being a little more understated, a little more physical, and not being as annoying as it usually is to me. And then to have him pull off that Rasputin thing and do the really understated head of the KOC meeting. You know, he was in a bunch of other stuff. Maybe I'm just looking to give him one because I feel like I've been a little harsh on him in the past, but I'm going to go with Belushi tonight.
And we're going three different ways again. And I totally agree with both you guys on everything you said, but I think Bill Murray rose above that opening. It was a weak Nick, but I don't know how much of that was on him. He is getting better on Update, the little shit at the KOC. I just thought it was a good night for Bill Murray all around. And you guys are right. Lorraine and Belushi also had strong nights as well. So overall, the crowd were there to see the Grateful Dead. Everything else was extra. Despite a high energy beginning, I think the audience tired of the comedy pretty quickly, and the energy was in the toilet for most of the night. The cast in some ways seemed completely checked out. Even Gilda, who's always game, was very almost forgettable tonight. As far as the characters, we got Samurai Futaba, better bit than usual. A weaker Nick, the introductions to Chico and Uncle Roy, who will both be back, Chico in a different format. The writing was subpar, energy was subpar, audience wasn't engaged. Music, I thought, was excellent. The few sketches that were good were, like, really good and high energy were at the top. And by the time we got to the KOC, there was no energy, and that may have actually helped that sketch along. I wanted to like this one because it was Buck, and I wanted to like this one because I like the Grateful Dead. But in the end, the best I could give this one is a 5 out of 10.
Ooh, I think I like this a lot more than you did. It was definitely a mixed bag. Lots of ups and downs. Really strong start, and then, yeah, sort of sputtered up and down through the middle. The music was strong for me. I always like Buck, even if what he's working with isn't the best. And I don't know, maybe that KOC finish like just brings it up to me. But really strong start, really strong finish, and some ups and downs in the middle. I'm going to give this a 6.5.
Excellent. Matthew?
Very hot start to the show that I thought the samurai sketch killed, but it kind of, you know, it picks back up. We get you know, that chinchilla thing, which came first, was really funny. I thought the uncle sketch was shocking and funny. The music, not for me, super subjective. A soft weekend update. I keep thinking about those itchy Italians though, that really stuck with me. Very middle of the road, but slightly above middle of the road. And I think slightly above middle of the road is a 6.
Wild. It's Buck Henry and a Grateful Dead, and I give it the shittiest mark. I'm really cranky this year, guys. I am not the loving person I used to be looking at these numbers. So with my 5, Matt's 6, and Mark's 6.5, we average out at a 5.8. The Internet Movie Database gave it a 6.8. They're nicer than, we're nicer than we usually are as far as our exchange rate of 1.5 is concerned. This episode is ranked 16th out of 20 for the year on the Internet Movie Database user poll. Can't really think of any reason why or why not. It's just one of the ones that are there. Below average based on what we're going to see this year or what we've already seen. And I hope that's correct because I was disappointed.
This is definitely an episode that happened.
Yeah. So, Mark, thanks again for joining us. We're going to see you again this season at least once.
The pleasure as always. Looking forward to seeing you again, fellas.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. And Matt, next week we're going to be back. Do you know who the host and guest is?
I know the host is Carrie Fisher. It was revealed earlier this episode.
It is.
Who are our musical guests?
It's the Blues Brothers.
Oh, good.
And well, you were very happy with their last performance on the Steve Martin. You know, not overly happy, not gushing, but you were a lot happier than I thought you'd be.
You're right. I did find it quite tolerable. So maybe I should lighten up.
So Matt and I will be back in about a week with Carrie Fisher and the Blues Brothers. But until then, we won't be going to see Foul Play and leaving Uncle Roy with anyone anytime soon here in SN Hell.